My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
All right, welcome back to another episode of The Mark Maw Show, where we talk about the decentralized revolution, how the world is changing as we look at it through the lens of politics, finance, and technology. Today, I am sitting down with another special guest. I'm talking about podcast host, media personality, Marty Bent. He's the host of the TFTC podcast. He's recently been featured on shows such as Glenn Beck, and he is on front. He's in front of what is going on as this world is changing. And I'm talking about it through the lens of politics, finance, and technology, and the merger of those three. And we are going to talk about all three of those topics: the economy, the markets, the signs that the economy is breaking down, but what does that mean for the market? How the monetary system of the world is changing, what's going on with the World Economic Forum, what they're talking about, and what is going to happen from that. So we're going to talk about all that. Let's go ahead and just jump right into the interview with Marty.
All right, Marty, thanks for hosting. I'm hosting you this time, but in your studio.
The tables have turned.
The tables have turned. I switched chairs. So here we are in the TFTC studios with Marty Bent. If you don't watch Marty's show, you definitely should. TFTC and read his every day, right?
I'm trying to get back to it.
Your daily.
It's been like 2 to 3 days a week. This week I'm getting back to 5 days a week.
So check out his email. We'll link to that stuff down below. Always love listening to your stuff. We share a very common worldview, so it's always a pleasure to get down, sit down and talk to you as well. A lot of things to cover today. You put out an article, I think it was this morning or last night, talking about the signs of economic stress are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to dig into that first. I was just saying before we sat down that I think this year is going to be better than most people expect, and that's a contrarian view.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get into a bunch of other fun stuff that I have planned.
But yes. There's been all these like disparate stories out there. I've been reading on Zero Hedge, and they're just like siloed. And so what I tried to do with this letter last night was to put a few of them together. And so what I focused on was consumer credit and savings, housing or real estate more broadly, commercial real estate and residential real estate, and then the used car market.
And you threw in layoffs.
And layoffs as well. And that tied into like commercial real estate. And so with consumer credit, it's hitting new all-time highs. Obviously, it fell significantly after the COVID lockdowns. People went into their houses, paid off their debt, had a lot more disposable income as they weren't traveling to work and eating out and all that jazz. But since then, if you look at like the slope of the increase of consumer credit since it started going back up in like mid-2021, it's a bit steeper than it was in the 10 years prior after after things started going back up after 08. And so we have that situation. Then you juxtapose that credit growth with savings rates, which are plummeting. They're at 2.7% of disposable income right now, which is the second lowest point in recorded history, with the first being 2.4% in 2005, right before the housing crisis. And so, and that was as of Q3 2022. So we have another quarter of which Christmas was involved with. So you have to imagine people were digging in their savings to do all their spending. And the retail numbers came in this morning, and retail sales were down 1.1%, which was
for Christmas.
Yeah, which was lower than expected. And so that savings rate's probably even a bit lower than it was in Q3 2022. And then you combine those two and add in interest rates. You have credit card rates hitting like 1985 levels, like around 20% on average. So that signals to me that the consumer is under an immense amount of stress. They're overextending themselves, going into more debt at the same time, blowing through their savings. And obviously prices are going up, food, energy. It's leveled off a bit, but it seems like oil's going back up. And so that was the one sort of theme that I honed in on, like, hey, consumers seem pretty stressed out. They're adding more debt at higher rates.
And although they haven't cut their spending.
No.
Which is weird.
Yes, because people, I don't know, I forget what podcast I was listening to, but it's like a social, psychological thing. Like, once you're used to getting a new iPhone every 18 months or getting the latest athletic equipment, you want to keep doing that. It's just like hard to let go of that, that tendency.
In the latest CPI data that just came out, the core inflation is very sticky. It's like not budging, which kind of shows this consumer is just not stopping spending.
No.
Yeah.
No. Well, and the core inflation too, it's like going, you got to think of what they're spending on, like food and energy predominantly, which is your essential goods.
Yeah.
Like, obviously we have an egg crisis in the country right now because of this bird flu, but people are freaking out about eggs, which is something I never thought I'd see.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. When, you know, we have this ranch out here, and this might be a little TMI for the audience, but my daughter was freaking out. At the time, they were having like a tampon shortage. And like, she was like seeing the news, and like all these girls were freaking out, and she was like freaking out. It's like the end of the world for her, you know? We have to go stockpile these things. So like, seeing, you know, whether it's eggs or that, like, I mean, the economy is just kind of breaking down, which I want to come back to. Okay, so the consumer's getting stretched thin. That's a horrible position, both spending or say saving or credit going up as savings are going down. Mm-hmm. So the consumer's getting stretched. It's not cutting spending yet. Then we have a couple other things, right? So the used car markets.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you see? What do you see in there? Like, what are you thinking about that?
So these are typically used cars, particularly like leading indicators of economic stress, because people are deciding, hey, they're either saying, hey, I need to get rid of this car because I don't need it. I can take an Uber, especially in an Uberized world. Like, right. People are weighing their monthly payment versus just paying an Uber to get to and from work, which does tend to be cheaper. Like, I Uber to and from here usually. Me and my wife have one car, and it's definitely cheaper than our car payment over the course of the month.
Especially when you add in parking and all the other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that market's great, but it's down. It was down, had like the largest monthly decline in December, but you also have to take into account that it also had this roaring bull market after 2020, when people moved out of the cities. They said, hey, I'm gonna live in the suburbs, I need a car if I'm in the suburbs, and so that sent prices of used cars skyrocketing. Another factor of that was the supply chains for new cars got completely borked. They couldn't find the parts, and so you had a supply constraint on new cars, so the used car market got flooded. But yeah, if you look at, I forget the exact stats, but the average monthly payment for, I believe,
it was $1,000, like, right?
Yeah, for 25% of used car owners, which is pretty high for your average consumer. And then on top of that, I didn't include it in the newsletter, but I saw the stat this morning. The 60-day delinquency rate for used cars is up 25% year on year. And so those delinquency rates, when people stop paying their bills, that's usually an indicator that they can't, and they're in economic stress. And so that wasn't included in that particular newsletter, but it's a stat I saw this morning. Year on year, 60-day delinquencies up 25%, which is a pretty material increase.
Yeah. I have a buddy who runs the auto auctions in California, and I was talking to him just this last weekend. And he said that there's still a lot of action, but he has seen a lot of weakness in especially the luxury car markets. The G-Wagons specifically have taken like a massive hit. Some of that is a lot of these cars were going $50,000, $100,000 over sticker.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
It's insane. I mean, we lucked out when we bought our car that we have. We bought it in June of 2020. Like, right, we left the city. We were in New York. We left early March. We were pretty early. And then we were living down the shore and needed a car, and so we bought a used car, locked in like a 4% interest rate. It was like $22,000. It was like the best time to get in, because we checked prices like a year later, and our car, even with all the miles we put on it, would have sold for like $30,000.
Yeah.
And a used car, it was 2017. And so another thing to factor, interest rates come into this story as well. The average interest rate on these used cars is 10% as yeah. well. And when you think a quarter of these used car owners are paying $1,000 a month
yeah.
plus that 10% interest rate.
I've seen a lot of people talking about the used car market. I've seen changes in lending standards where they're being much more relaxed, which is a problem because they're just trying to get units out the door, which again shows the consumer stress, the credit, the money's not there. And for sure, it's like a leading indicator to the point that you made, but do you think it really poses a systemic threat to the rest of the economy?
I don't think the used car market particularly.
Right.
I don't think like an implosion of used cars.
So it's just a barometer of the overall economy.
It's just an indicator that, hey, there's some subsection of the economy that's under stress, is either dumping these cars or not buying them because they can't afford them.
Yeah. And then we have the real estate market you covered, which I think goes into the layoffs you said.
Yes. So that's particularly with the REITs, the non-tradable REITs. Blackstone had their $69 billion REIT fund that they curbed redemptions to in November. Yeah. They recently got a capital injection from the University of California system of $4 billion. So I think that's back open. But then there was Starwood Asset Management also curbed redemptions to their $16 billion non-tradable REIT. And their explanation for why their investors were pulling money out is because they had a stellar 2020 to 2022 and they were taking profits. But I think, like, especially in this market, you want to, like,
people are scared. They want their money.
People are scared. They want their money. And even though these REITs perform really well the last couple of years, it signals to me that if these types of investors are pulling their money out of that first, it's for a reason.
Yeah.
And these REITs typically invest in commercial real estate here in the United States. And post-lockdowns and now with these tech layoffs going on, like the market for commercial real estate is seeming pretty bearish.
Yeah.
Because people are either working from home or if they are working in an office, a lot of these tech companies are beginning to lay off people at an increasing pace.
Especially, office space in Silicon Valley, for example, right? Mm. Really bad.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Let me just run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract's fine print? Or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I was looking at some of the data on Blackstone like a week ago. I talked about it in a different video. You know, the whole thing with the GBTC situation, mm-hmm. the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, and they don't really want to unravel that thing because they're making a 2% premium on that, which is super healthy. Blackstone makes 3.6%. Huh?
They're charging
3.6%. They're making, what was it, $2 billion a year or something like that, right? 3.6 on 68 billion, whatever that was. 20 billion. Or something like that. Sorry, I can't do math on the top of my head. Austin, what is that? What's like 3.6 of 68 billion? Anyway, it's even more murky. So just on a little side note, but they don't mark to market their assets. So it's all controlled internally, and internally they set the valuation of what their assets are. It's a BREIT that people invest into, and they don't even have any say of what assets they buy. So mm-hmm. who knows what they're even buying, and they could be buying junk assets, and then they're not marked to market. They set the valuation, which they're probably keeping artificially high because they're making the 3.6% off the back of it.
Right. And that's, yeah.
Did you forget what that is?
I don't know if my calculator has that many zeros.
Probably not.
It's probably like 2.3 billion.
Okay. It was a lot.
Anyway. Around there.
Side note, but okay. So back to this. So, those are great data points. The economic data is bad. It's mm-hmm. really bad. We could talk about 20, 30 more indicators, and it's all looking bad. We have the most extreme yield curve we've ever seen in history, which tells us a recession's coming. The unemployment number is low, but if you dig in the data, it's actually really bad. And we can keep going on and on and on.
Yeah, they don't factor in the participation rate, which is very important.
The participation rate, which is at its lowest point in history. I was trying to do a little research and look at when the unemployment rate was this low before and what the participation rate, but it was hard to get that data. But okay, so we frame it up and the economic data is bad. Mm-hmm. It's really bad, and we're hurtling to a catastrophe at the rate we're on, potentially. We can add in a couple more things just real quick. The baby boomers are all retiring. Under the ERISA law, they were able to invest tax-free, but they're forced to start cashing in and pay the taxes now when they're 73 or whatever. We have interest rates so high that all these corporations aren't going to be able to roll over their debt. Mm-hmm. And then if they can't borrow more money, they're not buying back their stock. So they're not buying as the boomers are selling. I mean, we can go on. The question I have is, so what? not so what, but more, what does that mean? So if we look at 2020, what we saw is that the economy does not equal the markets. The entire economy was literally shut down. It couldn't have been any worse. Businesses were literally put out of business, and yet the markets hit all new time highs. Asset prices, stocks, bonds, real estate, Bitcoin, etc. So when we're looking at the economic data and we're looking at all these data points, is it so like, what does the average listener care? Like, hey, you better buckle down because the economy is going to get bad. It might be hard to make money. Or for like investing, does that matter?
In terms of like asset prices, because I do agree, like in 2020 showed, like the markets do not equal the economy. But the key difference between 2023 and 2020 is Fed policy, right? Like you had the Fed seems pretty dead set on driving rates and keeping them there higher than 5%. It seems like every other day you have a Fed governor from some part of the country coming out and saying, yep, we're gonna raise rates above 5 and then try to keep it there through the rest of the year. So I think that's the number one factor that would lead to a different outcome than 2020, where you shut down the economy, lowered rates, printed a bunch of money, added government stimulus on top of that, and people simply have more disposable income that they weren't spending as they were traveling to and from work and hanging out. They weren't able to go to bars, go to movies, go to all that. So I think that's different today, where the interest rates particularly could bring markets and the economy closer to markets and the economy could be accurately reflected together instead of this disconnection that we had in 2020.
Yeah. Yeah, the Fed wants to crush demand, mm-hmm. so they want to crush the economy because they want people to be broke so they don't keep spending so much money. So maybe they're saying, hey, we're doing a good job, I guess. We're
crushing Larry demand. Summers will come out. I mean, he's not officially associated with the Federal Reserve anymore, but, I mean, he was on CNBC a few weeks ago sitting on a beach saying, yeah, we need to drive job loss here so that we can lower prices and get the economy on a solid base.
And that is a very scary thing that people need to hear again. So we're going to repeat that again. So they want to crush demand by making you poor so you don't buy as much stuff. They're trying to do that to get CPI down to the 2 to 3% range. But they also want to get unemployment up to 5%. Mm-hmm. They want more people to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
The Fed.
It's pretty evil. I mean, the Fed won't come out and say it. They need a proxy member like Larry Summers to come out and say what everybody knows they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you think about it, it just highlights the insanity and the perverse nature of Fed policy. Like they really only care about these numbers and not the well-being of individuals. At the end of the day, they've created this Frankenstein monster that they sort of lost control of.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to get control of this monster. And they're willing to do that at the expense of your everyday American.
Yeah. I mean, it's to come out and say we need more people to lose their job. And high wages is a problem for them. They mm-hmm. need people to make less money because high wages drives inflation.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, come on. Insanity. But I had said out there before we came in that I think this year could be better. And I was specifically talking about asset prices mm-hmm. Than most people think. And the reason why I'm shifting my thinking a little bit, I don't know if you saw, it just happened this week. The BLS came and said they're going to change the way they calculate CPI. And so
again, right?
They've done it multiple times. Using shadow stats, the latest CPI rating was 6.5%. Shadow stats says we're at 15.6% if you go back to how they calculated in the 80s. So now they're going to change the way they calculate CPI. And instead of looking at a two-year average of the comparables of the comp, it's going to be just 1 year, which is last year, which was the highest inflation we've ever had. So you measure from there, it comes down. And so even if inflation stays flat from here, which we're trending down pretty quickly right now, but let's just say and look at the economy, it's probably going to trend down even faster. But assuming it just stays flat, by the end of Q1, we'll be in the 3% range.
Yeah. But again, so yeah, they're just manipulating the base from which they calculate inflation. Even though inflation has come down, one thing that everybody has to consider is like going back to last year, inflation started running hot through the summer and towards the fall of 2021 started climbing up and then all the way through 2022. And so even though, yes, the inflation rate has come down like 6.5%, that's still growing on the bigger base that was
right. It's still going
last
up.
Year and still going up. And even if it is only 6.5% inflation is still very high.
Well, and it's really 15.5%.
Yeah, exactly. If we're using the Fed's manipulated metrics, I mean, their target historically has been 2%. They've been teasing like they're going to raise that up to 4%.
Yeah.
But even if it's 4%, you're still well above it, 2.5% above your target.
Yeah. So the reason why I would want to kind of make that distinction between the economy and the markets, and then now looking at this, if they can magically, or not magically, through changing the way they calculate it, could get CPI down to 3% by the end of Q1, that gives them all the political cover they need to be easing again.
Yes. Yes, it does. Definitely does. And maybe that's the intention behind the manipulation of the CPI number. But I also think we need to zoom out a bit and realize that the U.S. economy, yes, it's the largest economy in the world, but we're not in a bubble. There are some sort of negative externalities that can come from outside the U.S., particularly Japan right now, which I think is a canary in the coal mine that could throw a wrench in any plans the Federal Reserve might have, because the Bank of Japan is having a pretty hard time successfully controlling their yield curve.
Yeah.
And
they said they may abandon it.
Yeah. And they are the largest owner of U.S. treasuries in the world.
Yeah.
They own half of their bond market. And I think they own a lot of their stock market as well. I think that's why I'm more cautious going to this year. again, I think the economic data here in the U.S. looks pretty piss poor. And then, like, an even scarier prospect is this negative externality coming from somewhere like Japan, or if Europe, right? I mean, the U.K. got into a pension crisis not too long ago as well. There's like these events that we're not really aware of that can just pop up, and it's like the Mike Tyson quote, everybody has a plan to get punched in the face. Yeah. And I think it could be Japan, could be Europe, could be somewhere else, but I think there's somebody crouching behind the low in the bush waiting to punch the global markets in the face.
By the way, the first interview I did in my new studio in person was with Mike Tyson.
Really?
And the first question I asked him was, did you really say that? And I quoted it, and he said, yeah, I said that. It wasn't that good of an interview.
Was he high the whole time?
Yeah.
He's a big pot guy now, isn't he?
Yeah, it was pretty difficult. I think that, and he was eating mushrooms at the same time. And it was like sitting across the table from like a caged lion, except for he didn't have the chain on.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, you don't want to piss him.
And I was like, I kind of was like digging into questions, and I was like, oh, okay. So anyway, wasn't my best interview, but anyway, I did ask him that question. You had also talked about what's going on with the BRICS nations and even Saudi Arabia and the petrodollar. And so that also throws a massive wrench, right? So the Fed can control who's in their system, but if there's these other people moving into this other system, then they lose control over that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so this, I have a tag on my website called Oil Wars, and we start writing about this in September 2017. This issue hasn't made it on the website yet. I'm still going back and adding all the previous issues I wrote before transitioning to Ghost. But in September of 2017, it was the first time I spoke of these oil wars. And at the time, China was simply expressing its intent or its wish to denominate their oil trades in yuan with Saudi Arabia. And at the time, nobody really thought much of it. It was just like, China saying like, we'd like to settle this in yuan, and nobody thought it was a real possibility. Fast forward the last 2 years, obviously Russia, Ukraine, and the sanctions that came with it have really shown to the BRICS nations specifically that the U.S. can weaponize the dollar system, SWIFT, and even confiscate central bank reserves from these countries.
Yeah.
And so I think that's accelerated a move toward a decay in the petrodollar system, and this has really accelerated, particularly in the last 6 weeks, when President Xi went to Saudi Arabia and had a meeting with the Prince of Saudi Arabia and other GCC members, and at the end of that meeting expressed like, yes, we're going to strengthen our relationship with Saudi Arabia, we're going to begin buying more oil from them, and on top of that, we're going to settle these trades in yuan. We've set up this forex exchange in Beijing, I believe, or Shenzhen, that is going to allow us to facilitate these oil trades in yuan. And then you fast forward to yesterday, at Davos, a representative from Saudi Arabia was interviewed by Bloomberg, and he came out and basically confirmed, yes, we're going to strengthen our relationship with China, and we're going to do yuan settled oil trades, but on top of that, we're open to doing a settlement in other currencies as well. We can do it in euros, we can do it in real, and so that signals that the U.S. dollar reserve system is beginning to be significantly threatened, because that is what really gives the dollar a lot of its strength, is the fact that all these countries have to go, they buy oil from Saudi Arabia, convert it to dollars, and that drives demand for the dollar. And it seems like pretty quickly that is not going to be the situation anymore. And then when you factor in that China's opening back up, their economy is still growing, they could become a significant buyer of oil from Saudi Arabia, and it gives Saudi Arabia the ability to be like, hey, United States, thank you for the decades of an incredible relationship. The petrodollar system worked while it did, but we have a lot more buyers, and we're gonna appease them as well.
Yeah.
So you have this fractured sort of oil trade
Do you see the world continuing to fracture in this way? I mean, continuing to move into a multipolar world?
I think so, yeah.
Not just the BRICS, but maybe even into smaller factions?
Oh, yeah. The BRICS, I mean, you can, even here in the United States, like, I think we're sort of having a multipolar union, if you will. In states like Texas, Florida, you have the secession movement up in Idaho and Oregon.
Yeah.
That's been getting some steam, I think. I think that's going to be the big trend in the next couple decades is like at different scales going local, whether it's in a particular region of the world or even a particular region of the United States.
Yeah. And so then if the world continues to break apart, trust has continued to break down, the dollar, which has been the most trusted system, which isn't really trusted anymore, to your point, if Russia gets their FX reserve seized, I mean, what chance does anybody else have?
Exactly.
So you think that really opens up the door for a new form of payment settlement?
I think so in the long run. And if we focus particularly on like these oil trades and using different currencies to settle that, I mean, I do think Bitcoin is perfectly suited for all these trades from a mechanical and engineering perspective. It's a peer-to-peer distributed network that allows you to make transactions with a counterpart that you may not trust. You're trusting this distributed
network.
That's the
big piece, right?
You're not trusting that the U.S. won't take your money or say they're holding your money and just not give it to you. You can't do that with Bitcoin. So I do think from an engineering perspective, it's perfect to facilitate these types of trades. However, I do think there will be an interim period where you have the sort of fractured markets where the Chinese are setting yuan, maybe the Europeans defect from the U.S. and they decide they want to settle in euros and go on down the line. And that's simply because Bitcoin doesn't have a liquidity profile at the moment to facilitate oil trade on the magnitude that would be necessary. There would be a lot of slippage and stuff like that right now, especially if they're just using Bitcoin as a rail and then they automatically liquidate on the other end.
Yeah.
I do think when Bitcoin gets to a multi-trillion dollar market, the facilitation of those types of trade settlements will be better. And then also, I think if Bitcoin does get to that market, it signals that all these fiat currencies are being debased pretty heavily. And so people are adopting Bitcoin. And at that point, that's when it flips because the slippage you would have using a fiat currency to buy oil would be larger than the slippage that you would incur using Bitcoin because Bitcoin would be more stable at that point.
Yeah.
Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract's fine print, or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned liquidity, and like that's kind of like the big thing, right? So it's like people want to trade in dollars because they can use dollars anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And I guess I could trade with China now and they could pay me in yuan because I could just buy stuff from China back in yuan. But I probably wouldn't be able to buy stuff from other countries in yuan, or maybe some might take it because they know they need trade with China. But why would I take a smaller known currency, the Turkish lira? What am I going to do with the Turkish lira, right? Or Bitcoin for that example, right? So we need it to have more liquidity, more acceptance globally for them people to be able to receive it, like Russian ruble. Like we only take Russian ruble and they're getting paid in Russian ruble, mm-hmm. but what are they going to do with those rubles? No one's going to take them.
No.
So like you can get paid in Bitcoin, but you need someone else to take those Bitcoin from you.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, so we need more adoption. And it's funny, it's not even a chicken and egg problem. It's just like a...
It's an evolution.
Evolution, yeah.
Yeah.
Where people get more familiar with it, gets embedded into more merchant systems, which is happening. It gets embedded into more balance sheets as an inflation, or not an inflation hedge. Parker would yell at me for saying that, as a means to store wealth over time. But yeah, I think we're just going through the evolution. We're only 14 years into this. Bitcoin's still extremely young. Still a lot of infrastructure to be built out, but yeah. I do think slowly but surely over time it's all going to come.
Yeah, let's park that and let's jump to a couple other things, then we'll come back and tie that together. So you've been talking about on your Twitter feed the WEF is meeting. Klaus Schwab called out for everyone, all the people, to come and master the future. That was his call. We need to master the future, right? So these people have this grand plan, the global business leaders and influencers, et cetera, right? Have you been paying attention to that at all?
Yeah, I've been following along this week as these people have been getting on stage and word vomiting all over the world.
Yeah.
It is very creepy.
Any new plans that they have that you've seen that are different than what we already kind of know about?
I think one that people aren't aware of is the intent, or the World Economic Forum is starting to put out this narrative that it is essential to prevent cyber crimes from happening, that we merge the banking sector with the intelligence agencies, so that you sort of roll them up into one entity that's able to manage the monetary side of things and the financial side of things and the surveillance side of things. So that is one very worrying narrative that's coming out of the World Economic Forum.
So still kind of beating the drum on the cyber pandemic, the potential dangers, yes, of this cyber crimes or whatever, and then introducing new suggestions of how they could fix that.
Yes.
Which, of course, is more control. And
it's a private-public partnership.
Yeah.
You get the private banks and the intelligence agencies that represent the public, and you just partner them together, which is an incredibly scary thought experiment to go down, because I mean the intelligence agencies I think are some of the most evil entities on the world. I mean the CIA,
I don't even think that's debatable.
No, I mean it just came out, they just admitted that they killed JFK.
What about MLK?
MLK, yeah, the FBI is out there tweeting, we want to honor MLK. They were threatening to, they were telling him to kill himself, and many people think they were part of his murder. The CIA was started with Nazis. Like when we started the CIA, we pulled out all the Nazi scientists and engineers, and they started their psychological warfare with things like Operation Paperclip, Mockingbird, MK Ultra, and these are all, and people are like, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Like, no, this is all FOIA. This is all information you get from a FOIA request. Like, it's all out there. And then you have the FBI. I was like watching videos of Ray Epps yesterday, and it's like, this guy work for the FBI, he's like, everybody get in the Capitol. Like that was an obvious intelligence agency run, called a false flag. The FBI is notorious for entrapment. These people don't want to protect you. They want to incite you to give up your rights.
That Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping plot for the governor.
Yeah.
And FBI. Half of the people involved were all like government agencies.
Yeah.
Like they were all entrapping each other.
Yeah. It's
I mean, insanity. I was telling these guys earlier today how when I was a kid, because I'm old, when I was a kid, there was the Iran-Contra, Oliver North was, you know, brought up under the Reagan administration, whatever. And the Iran-Contra deal was they were taking drugs from El Salvador, flying them to Los Angeles, selling the cocaine in the streets, getting people hooked on crack, taking the cash, giving it to Iran, buying weapons, and then bringing the weapons back to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
And in Costa Rica, we were down there a month ago, and they have one of the planes crashed in Costa Rica, and they've turned it into like a restaurant now. You can go there, and they have the whole story there. And it's like, this is all documented. It's all in the open. Like, everybody knows this.
Yeah, and that's, and then you get into this whole, I mean, this is something I haven't really been paying attention to, which just highlights the hypocrisy of these agencies, which is the classified documents where Trump had some, I didn't even dive deep into that, but he had some, his house got raided. It was a whole big story. And we find out Joe Biden has some, and it's like, it's whatever. Like, it was a mistake. And it was very...
Do you think it's a whatever, or do you think they're setting him up to get him out because he said he was going to run again? And I don't want him to run again.
I mean, he can't run again. He can't think. He can't speak. He can't walk. He should not be president. It would not surprise me if that's their intention.
Yeah.
Either. But then there's this weird place where if they try to get him out before 2024, then you have Kamala Harris, who's just a walking incompetent.
Yeah.
Dolt.
Yeah. So getting back to the big WEF meeting that was going on, so Master the Future, the cyber pandemic, I was looking at a list of like topics that they were going to discuss, and one was about the next pandemic, how to prepare, prevent like the next pandemic from happening, which might seem reasonable to some people if they don't understand what's just happened.
Yeah.
But
how do you prevent the next pandemic? How about you don't create
bioweapons?
Bioweapons using gain of function.
That's a pretty good start.
Yeah.
What about, have you seen these 15-minute cities?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Netherlands is ground zero for this, where they're taking all the farmland.
Yeah.
And trying to create these, I forget what they're calling them, but these cities where everything you'll ever need in your life is within 15-minute.
Within walking or biking distance.
Yeah. It's scary. And again, like going back to WEF and Davos this week, they're still leaning into the climate crisis, which doesn't exist. They're using it as a fear tactic to try to coerce people to be like, all right, like the Netherlands thing. They're telling these farmers to give up their farmland because of the, I believe it's NO2 that they're.
Yeah, the cows, well, it's the fertilizer. Too much fertilizer is being used, which I've looked into that a little bit. And because we live in a complex system, central planners mess everything up. When they try to fix one thing, it creates all these unintended consequences. And because of rule changes they placed in the EU, it pushed all the cows and farming to the Netherlands. So it all got concentrated there.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why there's so much there is because of previous rule changes that took it from a decentralized state where it was all spread out across the countrysides like it should be, and it pushed it all into the one little area. And now they're trying to go, well, now we've created another problem, so let's go solve that. And the Netherlands, I believe, is like the top exporter of like food.
Yeah.
Right? So like the UN says 868 million, almost a billion people could potentially starve to death in the next 24 months. We have the largest exporter of food in Europe, and they want to shut them down.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Sense. And their justification for it doesn't make any sense. The whole carbon emissions boogeyman narrative is disgusting. And then with the cows, they use methane. But if you actually look at like the composition of the atmosphere, yes, methane is a heavier greenhouse gas, but if you look at its overall composition of the gases in the atmosphere, it's minuscule. Even though we're adding all this methane, it's not really doing anything to affect. It's not taking over.
And decomposing grass emits methane, decomposing grass on its own, and the cows eat the grass, and then they break it down even more. So we got the WEF, potential cyber pandemics, potentially putting in like IDs and basically taking away like anonymous use of the internet.
Yes.
Potentially health pandemics that they're planning for somehow or another.
There were some European representatives laughing at a U.S. representative on one of the stages they were on saying, hey, you guys are going to have to enact hate crimes and curb speech in the U.S. soon enough. It'll come. You guys are going to do it. So tax on free speech, you can add that to it. Klaus Schwab was telling everybody that by 2030, we're all going to have chips in our head. It's a pretty, if you think of everything.
It's scary.
That you could put in one dystopian novel. They're trying to check all the boxes.
Yeah. Now, I love your worldview on this because you see all this and you see it. You're not naive to it. But at the same time, you tweet all the time like, we will win.
Yes, we're going to win.
So explain that.
I focus on Bitcoin specifically, and that's what we have right out here in front of the studios. Fix the money, fix the world. I think a lot of the problems that we're describing right now emanate from the fact that we've broken the money. We need to fix the money. We need to fix the way we allocate capital. We need to fix opportunity cost. The ability to print money is completely perturbed. Opportunity cost and led to this misallocation of capital, and the people that have control of the money printing right now are allocating that capital towards these dystopian use cases that we're describing.
So like the government's printing a bunch of money and then giving them to these organizations.
Yeah.
I saw I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name.
They're subsidizing carbon.
He just put together a bill to stop funding the WHO, for example. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's kind of what you're talking about.
Should definitely do that.
Yeah.
Defund NATO, defund all that. But yeah, go back to, we're going to win because Bitcoin exists.
But if we had a fixed money supply that they couldn't artificially create, then they wouldn't have this money to give to these organizations.
Exactly. Yeah. They'd have to actually work hard for it and provide valuable services that people are willing to pay for, and then they could try to allocate that money that way, but it would just get driven out of office because it would prove to be a misallocation of capital yet again. But yeah, and I think since Bitcoin exists, I've been around for almost 10 years now, which is hard to believe. And even though we're down around $20,000, we've had a lot of punches to the face in the form of a degenerate industry in the crypto space, really giving Bitcoin a black eye. State of the protocol has never been better. More adoption than ever, more people self-custodying Bitcoin than ever. Bitcoin, I tweeted this out the other day, like Bitcoin is just extremely reliable. You know, it's going to produce a block of transactions that are produced in a peer-to-peer fashion that don't are censorship resistant roughly every 10 minutes. And that reliability in a world full of all this chaos is a godsend. Like, and I don't think people are pricing in that reliability yet. And then on top of that, I think from a distribution standpoint of the actual nodes in the network, the mining of the network has gotten a little bit concentrated here in Texas, but I think overall it is significantly more distributed than it was, let's say, 5 years ago. And I think every day that Bitcoin survives, keeps producing blocks, the miners keep producing hashes, it just gets harder and harder to shut Bitcoin down. And then on top of that, it's growing in mind share as well. There's more engineers coming to build on the network. There's more cool things that you can build on second layers like the Lightning Network. And this is just enabling this value transfer and these types of applications that have never been possible and really enable the individual to get away from all this crazy and to win. Because, I mean, the old tried and true trope is like, just vote harder and you'll get out of this. And that, in my opinion, is never going to work. We need to go build this system outside of the fiat system, and then we can then begin fixing things from there. And then on top of that, you just have the sovereign movement. There's more people buying ranches, spinning up farms, getting more in touch with homeschooling, school choice, those trends are growing. And then again, you have here in the States, this trend of individual states asserting their autonomy against the federal government. And
against BlackRock.
Against BlackRock.
Against ESG.
Yeah. What was it? I think Missouri, Florida, Mississippi.
Six states, I believe,
Arizona.
Divested their money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars, which is good to see. And still, obviously, you have like the NBC archetype, which is still doubling and tripling down on their love of authority.
Yeah.
And that's growing as well. But I think the sovereign trend is growing faster and stronger than it has in many decades.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's the reason why I kind of wanted to jump to this, and we put a pin on that kind of adoption piece, the road to evolution, we were calling it, is just because as humans, we only react when the pain's high enough. Mm-hmm. I've gone to chiropractic most of my life. I believe in the chiropractic and that our bodies should be aligned, but I typically only go when I'm in pain. Mm-hmm. I'm busy otherwise, right?
Yeah.
And so like the pain has to get high enough. And at some point the pain is so high that we'll act. From a US centric viewpoint, it's hard for us to get the money situation. But if you're in North Korea or in the Congo or in whatever, Turkey, like you're watching your money lose 100% of its value. Like what, I'll take the risk, right? I'll go into something else. But as we talk about the WEF and what's happening with the cyber pandemic, the health pandemic, all these things, I think it's just gonna keep turning that pain dial up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only gonna accelerate the adoption. People are going to need constantly, and to the point, the sovereign movement is being led because there's a need to become a sovereign person, right? And as they turn that dial up, more people will become sovereign, more people will find Bitcoin. And so I guess we have like the S curve, right? So the S curve kind of has this straight up, and I think we're probably in that period. And unfortunately, the pain dial gets turned up.
Mm-hmm.
The good is that people wake up and start moving into this new parallel economy and start building that out.
Yeah. No, and I think the pain dial, I mean, you mentioned it earlier. I think the combination of all these boomers retiring, selling their stocks, and the Fed being put, or it looks like they're going to be put between a rock and a hard place where inflation may still be elevated, but the economy is doing so bad that they need to begin printing money. And if you couple those situations where you have stocks plummeting because boomers are selling all of it, inflation's still high because of supply chains and just overall monetary supply growth, and the Fed begins printing again and then inflation ramps up again, I think that is a perfect shitstorm to really wake people up and feel the pain that will drive them to seek alternatives. Like, hopefully,
yeah,
if we do get to that point, I won't say it's a foregone conclusion, but if that point does come, people have to realize, I would imagine, that the Fed doesn't really have control, the government doesn't really have control, we need to go seek out alternatives.
Who has control then?
You do.
You have me? Control.
Or you as an individual.
We the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me just run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract's fine print? Or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Sue. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, something I was thinking about when I was reading that with Klaus Schwab, and he says, you know, master the future. And he's calling all these business leaders and politicians and influential people to master the future. And we need to go create this. And we need to do this. And this is our vision. But it's like, they didn't ask us. We didn't vote.
No.
Like, who are they, right? And so they want to create, you already mentioned it, the public-private partnership, fascism, corporatism. So if we get Twitter or Facebook to censor people, if we get the banks to not fund people, right, if we can get the private businesses to work together with the governments, then we can reshape the world the way we want without asking our opinion, right?
Yeah, we didn't even bring up the Twitter files where the FBI was embedded in Twitter's headquarters telling them who to censor and who not to.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I wanted to ask you about that. Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. We can get into Twitter files if you want. I was just thinking specifically, Musk said he wanted to buy Twitter to open up free speech. He said that he thought it was like for humanity. It was that important. It was like the most important thing in humanity or something to that effect. I forget. A lot of people guess about his ulterior motives. I made a video. His real motive was because he's trying to start this new payment system and whatever. But anyway, he has opened up free speech a lot on Twitter. And it already seems to be reshaping things pretty rapidly. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I definitely see people more comfortable putting out tweets that they probably would not have under the last regime. But again, yeah, like he has come out and say like we're gonna build like the Weibo of the West. And I don't know, I go back and forth with Elon. I trend toward, I think he might be like a false prophet where it's like everybody's like, oh, Elon, come save us, come save free speech. But there's like little things with what he's doing to Twitter that make me raise my eyebrow, like the like paying the monthly fee for the blue check mark. And if you don't pay, you don't get as much visibility or engagement, which is interesting. And yeah, I think if he, and he, I do agree that people seem to be speaking more freely on Twitter these days, but I don't think we should be dependent on Elon sort of waving his wand and saying you get free speech now. We should be building, similar to Bitcoin, alternative communication protocols. There's one, Nostr, that's come out, which is a distributed relay system that allows you to build Twitter-like clients on top of it. And due to how the relay system works, it's extremely hard to censor individuals. You can connect to many different relays. One individual relay can censor you, but the likelihood of all of them censoring you is extremely low. You could spin up your own and syndicate via your own relay. I think that's the solution to the free speech problem today. I do agree. I think people are speaking more freely on Twitter right now, but again, I'm not sure what Elon's motives are, but I do think there's just like this nagging thought in my head that he could be a false prophet where it was like, oh, you're going to save us and save free speech. And then it's just going to turn into a dystopian Weibo-like app.
I agree with you somewhat on that. But I think for me, it's more like we should never raise somebody up like that and think they're the savior.
Yeah.
I think there's good things that he's doing and there's probably bad things that he's doing as well. There's certainly things I don't agree with, but then I do like some of the things that he is doing, right? And so like it's okay to like, I like this, good job, this is bad, right? And so I think that's kind of how I see Elon. Like he wants to stick microchips in my brain. Like I'm not down with that.
No, it's like this is the push and pull I have with Tesla and SpaceX, particularly. Like Tesla, I think, is like a green energy grift. I think a transition to a fleet of electric vehicles on a global scale is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Then you look at SpaceX and he's sending rockets up the space and then landing them back on these very small platforms. And you're like, yeah, this is obviously extremely cool and definitely an advancement on this rocket tech that's probably going to be necessary.
Yeah.
Elon confuses me.
Yeah. So we don't need to have this. And I think the same way with politics. Like, I don't know what I am politically. I can't align 100% with anything. Like, I pick and choose different things, right? Generally, I side with more freedom, right? And mm-hmm. less government.
Yeah.
I was watching Ron DeSantis, and he came out with this whole speech, and he was talking about the WEF and how we need to crack down on the WEF. He's trying to do some stuff in the state, and the CCP, the Communist Chinese Party, and we want to ban the CCP from being able to buy land in Florida, which sounds great. I'm for that. We mm-hmm. shouldn't allow the communists to buy land, right? Except for, wait a minute, that means that he's going to restrict what I can do with my private property?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. It's
weird conundrum.
Right? And so, like, you have to really think through these issues, especially if we're trying to be men of integrity. So anyway, back to kind of like DeSantis, there's lots of things he's doing that I like. Some things I think that he is a dictator too.
Yeah.
And same with Elon and Trump and everybody else for that matter, right?
Yeah, no, and I can see, like, going back to like, Chinese buying land or property, told me a few years ago, like, you shouldn't do that. I'd be like, yeah, no, there's no way we should do that. I know Kyle Bass has been beating this drum as well. But then, like, in the Bitcoin mining industry, after the Chinese exodus, a lot of the Chinese miners have come over to the U.S. because they want to continue Bitcoin mining, and they're Bitcoin mining for a reason, because they believe in the ideals that Bitcoin was founded on censorship resistant, private property rights, and freedom to transact how you want to. And so I've been interacting just professionally with a lot of these Chinese miners, and we had to separate the CCP from individual Chinese men and women, and it's hard to do. It gets mucky, right?
Yeah, these are not easy issues, which is why they should be dealt with, I think, more on an individual basis and not centrally planned, you know, decisions.
Yeah.
So, taking that, and that actually kind of took us to where I wanted to go, because it seems like businesses are the ones that really create the change, and that's why they want to have this public-private partnership. They realize that government politics alone isn't enough. We need to get the businesses, mm-hmm. the banks, the social media, the corporations, Coca-Cola, et cetera, that we need them to get involved, right? So a couple things I think in there. So one, with Twitter going to free speech, it seems like to me it's changing things. Like, I'm starting to see a lot of information specifically on the pandemic and trials from Pfizer and stuff I don't want to say because I'm on YouTube here.
You can't say this stuff on YouTube. Susan, you got to end it.
Right. And so, but my point is so this is really opening up on Twitter, and Facebook's tanking. Do you think Facebook goes, shoot, we better change our policy or we're dead in the water?
Yeah, we have to compete.
We have to compete.
That's what the consumer wants, because at the end of the day, the consumer does drive these products. Wants.
And that's where I asked you the question. If they don't have the power, who has the power? We have the power. Really, the consumer has the power, right? At the end of the day, the consumer.
Yeah.
They want our money. And so who's going to give, if we're going to give them our time and attention, then they have to serve us. And so Twitter broke that seal and, hey, look, we want freedom or freedom of speech or whatever. And now Facebook and YouTube are going to have to deal with that.
Yeah, especially YouTube. You know, when I said Susan, I was talking to YouTube CEO.
The CEO.
Susan Wojcicki. Like, I got a strike. I can't monetize YouTube right now because.
Oh, really?
I had somebody on talking about what you're not supposed to talk about, which is.
I've had to not post interviews I've done on YouTube and just put them on Rumble instead.
Yeah, same. I've been doing that in the last couple of months because of the strike, but it's insane because we were literally just talking about facts that are public now.
Yeah.
That, going back to like trust the science.
Don't take my channel down, Marty.
No, I'm not. But like talking about trust the science, you can talk about particular peer-reviewed studies, but you can't talk about others or you get kicked off. Believe me, I know. I know what not to say to make sure this gets on YouTube. But yeah, at the end of the day, consumer drives it. And going back to we're going to win, that's a do. Even though things are seem dire, the populace here in the United States seems a bit complacent, seems a bit degenerate. I do think at the end of the day, good beats evil. And somewhere down in most people's stomachs, there is this craving for freedom, mm-hmm. for truth, for a reality in which people are good to each other. And I do think that's beginning to rear its head. And maybe give Elon some props. That is one thing we needed to begin changing the tides at the corporate level, is somebody with the balls to stand up and say, hey, no, We're going to bring Ed Dowd on. We're going to bring Trump back on. We're going to bring all these conservatives who were banned over the last few years and let them have open debate on my platform. And then
that's how the truth is found.
Yeah.
Open debate.
Consumers flock there. And then, like you said, Facebook's like, oh, damn, we're losing people.
Yeah. And if they start adding more features to take more share from Facebook, Facebook's going to have to respond, right? One thing you're going to see me really starting to pound the table a lot this year on is that this is kind of where I'm really starting to push back to this sovereign thesis kind of world or parallel market world, because this is where I just really see the most power we have is to affect change through the economy, through economic means. You had Vivek on from Strive Asset Management, mm-hmm. right? And he created a parallel to BlackRock. But instead of trying to say we beat them on returns or we have better performance or better customer service, no. He just said we serve a different customer with different values, right? And there's examples of this popping up all over. And I think we, the consumer, has the power because we have the money. And if we start demanding businesses to cater to us or we don't give them our money, then they'll cave. And I think there's an even bigger opportunity for entrepreneurs to go create all these, like Texas Slim's done with the Beef Initiative. But I don't know if you've seen Ben Shapiro on Daily Wire. He created Jeremy's Razors. Mm-hmm. And the examples are starting to pop up. And there's a massive opportunity for entrepreneurs. And then we as consumers get behind it and like we win. And then, of course, the banking system won't like that. They'll shut us down and we have Bitcoin. And right, yes. That will underpin, that will be what makes it all possible.
Yeah, no, and I like to think I'm trying to build one of these products, which is in terms of content creation. So for our site, tftc.io, we spun that up in April of 2019. So it's been around for almost 4 years now. And we spun it up using Ghost because Ghost is open source and it's easy to build on. And when I launched the site just selfishly, I wanted to incorporate Bitcoin payments using an open source payment processor called BTC Pay Server into Ghost. And so over the last 4 years, we've sort of been building that product out for ourselves. And I've actually come to the conclusion, oh crap, like we could package this up and give it to people so that they can do exactly what Substack's doing, but in a self-sovereign fashion, particularly with Bitcoin payments that you host yourself, because Substack's an incredible platform. I think they're another example of a company that decided not to censor people, and they've seen an extreme amount of user flow because of that. People mm-hmm. are craving truth. They're going to Substack because Substack has drawn the hard line. We're not going to censor these hard conversations. But the censorship that happens on Substack is via Stripe, the payment mm-hmm. processor.
Yep.
That's what some content creators, even though they're able to write on Substack, they can't monetize on Substack because Stripe has stepped in and say, hey, we're not going to allow you to use our rails to receive money. And so if that trend continues and the government doesn't like that Substack is having this free open discussion, and they go to Stripe and say, all right, demonetize all these people, that's going to just gonna ruin Substack for those writers. And so this is just one small thing that we're trying to build at TFTC. We're trying to package up what we've built with Ghost and BTC Pay Server. We're going to open source it for everybody, but we'll also have a centralized platform that if you don't want to do everything yourself, we'll help you do it. Just plug in some API keys and tokens and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and you'll be able to inject the Bitcoin payment processor code into your Ghost. And so, I built that for myself because, as you may know, with the newsletter and the podcast, I talk about some topics that the government and others don't like. And so I'm not big enough to get censored, but I built this with the intention of getting big and potentially getting to the point where they're like, hey, we're going to censor you. And I can just look at them and be like, no, you can't. Like, come take my node.
But by us spinning up those businesses and even just requesting to get paid in Bitcoin, then more people use it and the adoption happens, the pain dial gets turned up and it all starts going pretty quickly.
Oh yeah. I think it's going to be, and that's the other thing with Bitcoin too, like, in terms of adoption, that's definitely happening here in the West. Strike, their implementation with NCR at self-checkout should be coming to market soon. So if you want to go and pay at Whole Foods or somewhere, if they download this NCR software, you'll be able to do that. You can pay from any wallet. You don't need to pay from a Strike wallet. So that allows you to sort of live and spend on a Bitcoin standard. But even more importantly, I think what's happening, like emerging markets like Africa and Latin America, where these people actually desperately need Bitcoin's utility as a payments vehicle and a wealth preservation vehicle, is really going to drive a lot of the adoption over the next year. So that's actually my one of the bullish cases for Bitcoin in 2023, is that we have this black swan adoption event in emerging markets where there's a lot of activity going on right now. And even if the government here in the US or other Western governments decide we don't like Bitcoin, we're going to stop it. I think what's happening in developing markets is something that many people aren't paying attention to. It could sneak up on the global.
I think that's the big growth area. Like if you look at the internet, the US internet grew fast because we had wired phone lines. But in emerging markets, it skipped that and went straight to wireless, right? Mm-hmm. And so here we have these existing USD payment rails. Over there, they don't. So it just skips and just goes right to a new rail,
it's
right?
It's all mobile first.
Yeah, it's all mobile first. It goes right to a BTC rail. So cool, man. Well, we covered a lot. I think we'll wrap it up with that. TFTC.io. Check that out for sure. What else?
At Marty Ben on Twitter. That's...
start a business. Accept BTC, check out the payment gateway with Ghost. Well, when it comes out,
yeah,
we'll follow Marty for updates on that.
Yeah, we'll be open sourcing it soon, so we're just making sure it's stable. So you can follow all that stuff. Podcast is TFTC. Rabbit Hole Recap is the other show I do. But Mark, thank you. This is I think this is the first time the tables have been turned in the studio.
Oh, nice. Well, I'm glad it was me.
This is a comfortable seat too.
Ah, nice. All right, thanks.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.